You can see my award-winning climate comedy show Spoilers at a festival near you, provided you live near or are going to McCunclith or Wells comedy festivals. More dates added soon near you, conceivably, who knows what might happen.
And if you are at Mac, come and see ComCom Redacted live at 4 p.m. on the Saturday.
Go to stuartgoldsmith.com and click the very attractive banner image to find out more.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
This is a podcast from ComediansComedian.com.
This is the Comedians Comedian Podcast.
Hello again, Stuart Goldsmith here. Thanks for joining us. Today we are talking to a wonderful comedian, as we always are, only wonderful comedians. This episode, here's the fabulous Mark Mayer. I remember my first memory of you, my abiding memory of you, is that the first time we met when we were on getting the flight to those Riviera gigs. And we met at the airport, and you tickled me, you physically tickled me, well before it was socially acceptable to do so. We hadn't met each other, and it really made me warm to you, because you never know when you're going on a sort of, foreign travel gig, yes, with other comics. If you haven't met them, you don't know necessarily whether you're going to get on. And we said hello, and we chatted and so forth. And then as we were walking along, you kind of went, whoo, and just
tickled me. You know what? I think I do that a lot. I've had that. And what's interesting, and if it's the person I think it is, who shall remain nameless, because I wouldn't want to sully anyone's name, I think I did that to a comedian who turned around and went, don't you fucking touch me.
Really?
What? Sorry? What? It's just... Do you sort of understand? Some people don't like to be touched, tickled, poked or prodded.
But is that...
I honestly think it's a subliminal thing. I wasn't at the airport going, you know what I need to solidify my friendship with Stuart is a little sort of cheeky tickle.
Yeah.
It's a subliminal thing. And I did get quite yes, I'm sure.
You've been told off
for it. Unless I'm talking about a dream I had of tickling. I have these recurring dreams of tickling comedians. No. And I do, and I still do. I can think of that. Yes, I'm quite... Maybe it's quite a tactile...
Yes, thing. I liked it. I liked it because it was totally inappropriate. And I remember thinking, oh, there we are. You're a funny person.
But, oh, really?
Yeah, that's not necessarily. I didn't think, this means he'll be great on stage.
Right.
But I thought to myself, you are someone who...
A little irreverent and left
Yes,
field,
a bit or? Irreverent or a bit, yeah, a bit kind of willing to necessarily be confined by the rules.
Right.
Someone I asked, I did a really nice interview for a podcast done by Izzy Lawrence and Simon Bond over the weekend. It's called The Sunday Supplement. And Simon asked me a question, which I wish I had thought of. I'm crediting him because I'm not going to nick his question. But he said to me, do you feel like a comedian? And I'd quite like to pinch that and ask you that wholesale. Yes. But what I was thinking was, because my answer to that was, I definitely feel different.
Mm.
Do you feel different to other people? Like, there aren't a lot of middle-aged men walking through airports tickling people they've only just met. As far as I know.
Funny, that's actually sort of pseudo-topical at the moment, isn't it?
Oh, because, God.
Yes. Don't go there.
Do you feel... No, that's...
I'm fixating on who I've tickled in the past.
It was a badly phrased question. Do you feel different because you're a comedian? Do you feel like that is your identity in the world? Or is it just a job that you do and actually...
It's certainly not just a job that I do, because I've always been interested in comedy ideas, in funny stuff, whether watching it, performing it, doing it even at college when the young ones were... huge, feeling the need to sort of this overriding desire and urge to be one of the young ones. It was a sort of most sort of painful.
Yeah, God, thing. I think I felt that.
I have to be one of the young ones. Mind you, I also had that with Elvis. I have to be Elvis. He's dead. I've got to, but that was less comedic, I suppose. But no, certainly there was this desire to be in amongst it, to be in the thick of it, in that sort of world of comedy. But no, I wouldn't say I feel different from, you know, I've got funny ideas and I enjoy being funny or being amusing, hopefully. But not, I wouldn't set myself an elitist kind of, you know, I'm different from...
Sure.
The other people.
You're not like a spirit walker. Yes,
exactly.
I see jokes when, you know, where other people see only walls and trees.
Exactly.
Okay. I mean, we're sat in what I can only describe as, I mean, it's basically a drawing room, isn't it? It might be your living room. We're in North London and it's a fairly alien world to me. There is a framed picture. It's a holographic picture of the Queen. Is it holographic?
It is holographic. I don't know. It sounds good.
That's the only detail I'm willing to give.
It sort of moves when you look around.
Yes. Yeah, it seemed to. Yeah. I mean, this is...
Yes, we're in the east wing of my...
Yeah.
Stop it.
I think what I'm trying to say is you've obviously made comedy work.
What I'm trying to say is my wife...
you've taken me rich
wife
route.
I can't possibly... Yeah, it's done all right. Yes, it's done well. I wouldn't necessarily make the association between where I'm living and...
Okay.
But no, it's, yeah.
Okay, because I walked out the drive and I thought, God, he must do a lot of writing work.
God, he must have another job. Yeah. Sure he is, yes.
I always thought, in terms of other jobs, I always thought if you could, when I was doing lots and lots of driving gigs for very little money in the early days, I always thought if the other job that you could do was haulage, that'd be brilliant. Like, comedy would be a great job for a truck driver. Because if you've got to go to Exeter and back, if you could also take 10,000 Barbie dolls, you know what I mean? You could do the gig and get paid doing it.
Yeah, two jobs for the price of one.
Yeah
absolutely.
Perfect.
Yeah.
So let's go back to the beginning then. Let's start a bit more simply. Why did you become a comedian and how? What was the moment when
I suppose it was the whole seeing comedy, and which you've probably, you know, it is probably a stock answer, I would have thought. From a lot of comics, you see stuff and you have this sort of urge to get involved in comedy. And my route was a bit not straight, you know, jumping straight into doing stand-up. I worked in advertising. I did a degree in advertising.
Okay.
And then became a copywriter.
Mm-hmm.
So I was writing ads, which then moved more specifically into radio ads, which I absolutely loved.
And you came to that... whilst presumably at the same time, this was in the time when you were wanting to be in the Young Ones and wanting, you know, you felt all that kind of, I want to be part of
but
something.
But didn't know how to be part
of it.
It
felt like it was a completely closed door.
Exactly. Didn't have the tools in order to do that. Exactly. It was another world. It was something else. Stand-up wasn't that huge as it is now.
Mm-hmm.
So I found that the writing was an outlet. And interesting enough, when I look back on it now, writing ads... is basically selling a product. Writing stand-up is selling yourself, isn't it?
I mean,
so it wasn't that far removed. So when I was writing these radio commercials, whether it would be a 30-second ad or a 40-second ad, you suddenly had to be very concise, as I'm not being now, selling a product within 30 seconds. And then, so there was a discipline there. I thought, well, this is quite interesting. During the day, I was doing this copy. By day, I was a copywriter. And by night, I started showing, you know, being interested in maybe doing an open spot here or there. And then writing stand-up for myself. So when I had free time, I worked at LBC Radio. When I had free time at LBC Radio, that I would then work on stand-up ideas. But using the same disciplines as I would do for the copywriter.
So were you writing one-liners then at the time?
Writing short little bits, little observational bits. But trying, thinking... Right, let's see if I can hone this down, get to the actual sort of meat of the...
So when you were writing adverts, when you were writing short sort of copy, what was the pattern then for... What was the system? They'd go, okay, here's a bottle of Glenfiddich, how does the brief come to you?
These are the key points we want to get in. It's a fantastic drink. I don't know, whatever else. So a plug to the you've got to mention the where you can get this, the outlets you can get it, blah, 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 blah. So these would be salient points, relevant points that you'd have to get into that ad. But in amongst that, let's create a little scenario, a little scene, a little amusing pastiche of something or other.
Okay. I think of copywriting as just the text of the advert, but you mean it's you come up with the whole concept of the...
Well, for radio, I'm talking about specifically
okay.
for radio.
Okay, oh, sure.
With a press copy, you'd work with an art director. Mm-hmm. He'd come up with the image, or sometimes okay. you'd come up with the image, but invariably you'd come up with a headline and, you know, the copy, and they'd come up with the image or whatever.
Okay.
So,
okay.
I mean, there was an I worked in Edinburgh, and we was an advert for Scottish Brewers, and they their claim was that they never, ever brought you a dud pint. They it was the delivery side of Scottish Brewers. Okay. So... I came up with an idea of the Scottish Brewers truck with one of the tyres sort of let down on in the middle of the Highlands, and it was the headline was over 40,000 pints delivered in only one flat.
Oh, nice. So okay, yeah, lovely, flat. Lovely.
And the great thing about that was that they liked the ad, but also I got them to go on a sort of 5-day shoot up to the Scottish Highlands and, no, let's position the truck here, let's try the back tarbing, you know.
Sure.
So it was, you know, that was fun. What's nice there is it's a nice creative process that you can see the end of. You come up with an idea, it's not that far removed from writing a joke and then performing it on stage and getting a laugh. You come up with an idea for an ad, you see it to its fruition. Mm-hmm. You see the printed thing in the paper. It all holds together. It all you know, looks.
As someone who was a fan of something as anarchic as The Young Ones, I don't know what other sort of comedy you were into at the time as well. I assume it's sort of a broad range. Specifically, advertising. I think what I'm getting at is, I've always thought, oh, I'd probably be quite good at that. I think any comedian would probably be good at copywriting because, as we said, the parallels. I was totally indoctrinated by the Bill Hicks, you know, if you work in advertising, you're dead to me, that whole kind of quasi-political sort of thing. Like, I've always been, because I used to be a street performer, it seemed to be noble in a way that probably doesn't marry with someone walking past, you know, a grotty circle show, so with someone you know, juggling balls and, you know, whatever. But it seemed to me to have an inherent nobility. When you were doing copywriting, did you feel like there was any dissonance between I'm trying to sell a product on behalf of someone else and your own artistic ideals?
I suppose it was a frustration in as much as there was no greater sort of worthy cause. I shouldn't be doing this. This is immorally reprehensible, morally reprehensible. The frustration, I suppose, was why am I selling the great new nutty cheese? I could be selling the great new nutty me. Why am I selling the great new nutty cheese? I could be selling the great new nutty me. I mean, a hilarious line destroyed by the...
Yeah, I know, I'm sorry. Plastic. I was going to say...
It was almost like, no, that's it. No,
yeah. I'm sorry. That was
I'm going to heckle you via plastic.
Yeah.
It was the frustration of not being able to sell myself. I'm not frustrations to sort of bigger word, I suppose. But no, I've got to sell a product. That's my job, to sell products. What I'm really interested in, writing funny stuff, not selling a product, but writing funny stuff and sort of talking about me or things that I find funny. So, you know, and I love Woody Allen, I'm a huge fan of, and I love that sort of economy of words. And there's the classic Woody Allen, the Nightclub Years CD, which holds the test of test of time.
Yeah, I always brilliant. Think it's a bit when he's in the hostage situation and they're saying, give us the girl, throw out the gun.
Yeah.
He's doing all those different variations
give
on that.
Give you the gun, I'll throw out the girl.
Yeah.
Give me the girl. Yes.
Leave the girl.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah, brilliant.
Now that and the moose sketch and all those brilliantly written, not a word wasted things that I just sort of really sort of excited me, I suppose, and thought I want to do that kind of thing.
So how did you bring yourself to stand up when you started doing open spots at that time? What kind of thing? What kind of preparation were you doing?
I've told you slightly out of context. When I did the advertising, a friend of mine got married in Los Angeles. I went over to America and I had dual nationality, as they say.
Okay.
Dual nationality, so I could work over there. My mum's American, so I could work in America without the whole rigmarole of passports and visa thing and this and that and the next. So I got a job in advertising over there.
Mm-hmm.
Carried on working as a copywriter and writing radio ads, which was great. And the place where I worked was a guy called Dick Orkin.
Okay.
Dick Orkin's Radio Ranch in Los Angeles. And I worked in Hollywood in Los Angeles writing radio ads, sitting around a table with other writers writing radio commercials, which is probably a bit not that dissimilar to writing how they did sitcoms.
Sure.
Or maybe still do sitcoms. 6 or 7 writers would sit around and come up with ideas for radio ads, and then the best ideas would be pitched forward to the to the. So I was doing that, and then it was more, you know, stand-up was quite interesting and sort of buzzy over there, and as was impro, and I started doing improvised comedy over there.
Okay.
And being British at that time, we're talking about 140 years
ago. That must have been a superpower.
It was. I mean, I'm talking about 25 years ago now,
so
I've been doing it a long while, Stuart, a long while. Was great. It was being British at that time and doing stand-up or improv. So I started to cultivate a little stand. I did improv and that went well, and started doing stand-up. And it, in a way, it was a sort of a false beginning because, you know, it was the classic. Oh my! Say that again. I love the way he said garage.
Sure, and, sure.
So you weren't really doing the joke, but garage. He said garage. It's like garage. Is that the, you know? So that they would be sidetracked with that.
So you were getting kind of false positives of your ability.
But in terms of ego and boost and confidence building, it was tremendous. So I was playing the improv, the Comedy Store in Los Angeles, and other various venues that are hopefully still around. And that was tremendous. So I did that for a year and a half. And then I came back from America to London and almost had to start again because suddenly...
suddenly the word garage isn't funny anymore.
Well, you're English, mate. Yeah, but look at the way I say it. Yeah, you say it the same as... Yeah. Same as we do. What's funny about that? No, so it was the whole... I had the tools, I suppose, the very sort of... the tools of the trade in terms of learning mic technique and all that and confidence with an audience, but material was starting from scratch, which was kind of interesting. And then I carried on doing the improv stuff here as well.
Okay.
So
and when you were doing what sort of improv stuff are we talking about? Are we talking about you were doing like improv games, like the sort of
Who's Lies in Anyway
style things?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So I did that and I taught that and ran stuff doing that pretty much every week in Camden.
Okay.
And that was great fun. Thoroughly enjoyed that. And that actually really helped the stand-up, but, you know, being loose on stage and emceeing. And
That's something Sarah Pascoe said, which is she's confident that if she keeps talking for long enough, she'll find a funny end to whatever sentence she's saying.
Right.
Because you know what I mean? Which is useful in that that's not how she would do her stand-up, but in the creation of the stand-up, I think she was saying her improv background gives her the tools to take more risks and consequently come up with better stand-up.
Yes, yeah.
So you were teaching stand-up in London?
Yes.
No, you were teaching improv or you were teaching stand-up?
Teaching improv.
Okay.
Teaching improv.
And in what kind of a format was that? Was that like a once a week to some dudes? How did they know about
I advertised in places like The Stage and around these workshops in Camden.
At the same time as you were an open spot on the stand-up set?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So, but the improv I felt more confident with because it's so structured and disciplined in America. I took those disciplines and so I'd introduce different games and stuff into the improv and then people would come along, sign up, pay me to do workshops. So there's an inherent sort of pressure on me. So we do a workshop for an hour and then we do a show. We'd literally go into the street and go £5 or £3 or just £1, whatever you want to pay, come and see her. And, you know, whore ourselves to get people to come and see. And then we just do what we'd been rehearsing. Catherine Tate, who is a good mate, was one of the people who came along to the workshop. Mm-hmm. So I was sort of teaching her improv and Ella Kenyon and various other actors and actresses who, you know, I had to let go because they were holding back my career.
Yeah.
And that was great. No, it was really, really fun. And I would in a shot, I'd go back to doing that. I mean, I occasionally do stuff with the Comedy Store Players, you know, Paul Merton.
Oh, yes, Johnson, yeah,
that's brilliant.
Those shows are fantastic,
I feel, you know, a real newbie with that because they're so slick and so fun. And it's like anything, you keep doing it. They do it every, you know, Sunday and Wednesday, and you get really, really good at it. It's almost, there's this psychic kind of thing going on there, the preemptive thing that you...
I've got to do more improv because I think all the improvisers I've met are so happy. They're happy people. And I think, well, tell me what you think of this. Does this make sense as a hypothesis? That you... When you are an improviser, you have a sort of a self-reliance because you know you can do the thing. Like, I always think, and this is something that becomes an increasing theme of my podcast, I'm very kind of angst-ridden about comedy a lot of the time, I think. And I feel a perpetual sense that I'm only getting away with it. Right. You know, I got away with this gig. I've got away with the last gig. I've got away with hundreds and hundreds of gigs, but I always think I'm getting away with them. But whenever I speak to improvisers, I think of you, I think of Sarah Pascoe, Rob Broderick as well, who performs as a band man. There seems to be like an internal well of confidence that's based on the fact that you can be thrown into a room with nothing and come up with something.
I think, well, it goes back to what we talked about initially about being a funny person, or do you feel funny, or is it slightly manufactured? If I can go on stage and improvise and be loose, and I think it's true of you, me, anybody, if you can play the room, which does require a certain amount of improvisational skills, because if you're purely and strictly a writer who just goes out and performs what he has written, he or she has written, then that's a different sort of discipline, and it works brilliantly. And you know, you could name millions of comedians that do that. For me, I like to try and do something with the room, play the room. I listened to Alan Davis podcast, and he was, I remember when I was starting out, just watching him, being amazed at how effortless and brilliant he was at doing that. And you suddenly feel like, I suppose the improvisational skill is, you suddenly feel like you're not just knocking out the same opening line, however casual and relaxed you might be, night after night. I, as an audience member, feel this is something quite special, because you're actually, you couldn't possibly have been written that joke about that funny lampshade above the stage, or the bloke with the strange cough that everybody's noticed three rows back. So there's something more, I suppose, organic and more, you know, sort of more relevant.
I think the trap I fall into is it can be, it's not necessarily a trap, but I write things in advance rather than bringing myself to it. Like when I used to compare, I don't compare so much anymore. Someone gave me a piece of advice, I forget who.
Stop comparing.
That you should walk on with nothing in your head and completely react to what goes on. And I try and do that sometimes.
Yeah.
Other times, if there is something funny I can think of to say about the room, like I did a gig in Tunbridge recently, which was had this weird little barn structure of a stage, a little wooden stage inside it, and there were three cables wrapped up at the back of it.
Right.
And I walked in and I said, oh, look, it's like a nativity telling the birth of Christ through the medium of cables. And it was ludicrous. It was quite funny.
Yes.
But I thought of it beforehand. I'd sort of, a couple of 5 minutes before I'd gone on, I thought, what can I say about this? It looks a bit like a barn, blah, blah.
Yeah.
And I'd written that joke. I mean, are you talking about walking on stage with nothing and improvising?
No,
how pure is that moment of improvisation?
Sometimes doing that, and some what you've just described, and sometimes, yes, going on and purely improvising. Funny, on the wire theme, this at the Manchester Comedy Store, they've got very thick wires that drape the back of the stage, which I've, if I'm feeling in the mood to sort of mess around about, I suppose. Yeah. Remember, as a kid, those long licorice shoelace things?
Yes.
They look very much like that. Now, on one night, I can go out and go, because I'm feeling, you know, when you feel the funny, you go out and you can be talking about, you know, talking about anything, improvising about anything, and I could mention the licorice shoelace thing, and they go, oh, yeah, we know what you're talking about. Yeah, we remember. Mm. There can be other nights, for whatever reason, the way in which you say it, the order in which you say it, however improvised it may look, they turn around and go, I don't know, we want them out. I don't know. I don't really get where you're coming from. I think it's the skill of, I suppose, if you are truly improvising, sticking with what you've done. Let's say you did that thing at Tunbridge Wells and they didn't go with it. Where do you go? You can't suddenly go, I thought it was quite funny. Or as soon as those little chinks of insecurity, then they're on you like a pack of wolves in terms of, right, you're not that funny. Is that it? Is that, is this what you do?
Why did you think that would be funny? That proves you're an idiot and we're not going to like you.
Whereas I think someone like Eddie Izzard would do that, or possibly even Ross Noble would do that observation, possibly get nothing, but go, I'm going to sticking with this and create a whole...
And start acting out the nativity with cables.
Exactly, with, Jesus being brought to life through electric cables or whatever, things that would occur to them there and then, and keep pushing and pushing and pushing. I mean that's the kind of, you know, I suppose improvisation I enjoy watching. That
a lot of the tension for me in whether or not to improvise, and I really enjoy it, but I feel like at the moment my development as a comic is about taking away blocks rather than adding things. It's about taking away obstacles, which I think is an improv-y sort of thing to say. I understand that's one of the sort of principles. And I find it easier to do that if I don't care about the gig. If it doesn't matter to me financially or in terms of reputation, or if it's, this was a lovely little, this Tunbridge Wells gig, it was, I cared about it, but there was only seven people in the audience. It was right. Sort of like, you know, sometimes you approach a gig and go, well, this is already a disaster, so I can do what I want. And sometimes you have an incredible night of it because yeah. You have that just complete freedom. If you're doing a 20 at the Comedy Store in London, you might not have give yourself that freedom to improvise. Do you see what I mean?
Yeah,
that
yeah.
Like, maybe it's to do with giving oneself the freedom when it really matters as much as one would give oneself the freedom when it doesn't.
Exactly.
Do you think that plays a part in it for you?
Yes. And I'm trying, and I still try. I know exactly what you mean. I'd like to say, I don't know what you mean when you say gigs you don't care about as much.
Yeah,
as
I mean, I don't care. Yeah.
For the promoters that are listening to this, every gig is special.
I care about your gig.
Do you like to drive to Truro for petrol money? Insert name, we'll be there to see you. I'm trying to go on with that attitude of I'm so pleased to be here,
yes,
irrespective of where that is, and that then gives you, I think, you that then gives you the boost to the impetus to then be free and yes. Enjoy yourselves and muck around. I did a gig recently, I think it was at Hastings, and drove God knows how long it took. And anyway, it was, you know, one of those road diversions. Even the sat nav is sort of giving up, just turning itself off. And I got there, and there was the front two rows were busy in this beautiful old theatre, but no one else was there. And the first act went on and played the gig exactly what I was talking about before. Great lines, great material, but there was no connection. And I felt going on, well, I had the benefit of going on, you know, the second spot, of being a bit looser, but also acknowledging the fact that there was only two rows.
Yes.
Full, but I know you lot are here, and we, you know, to for a great night. You know, you're not responsible for bringing your mates or whatever. Playing the room, playing the occasion, and making them feel like this isn't just something. You're not trotting out the same stuff that you were doing in Cardiff last week or in Burnley before.
That is a real intangible quality, I think, of watching pros, like seasoned pros. You know, like proper people who could headline the store, proper seasoned pros. I'm only really now just articulating that, I think, that when you see someone, like when you watch Bob Mills, do you know what I mean? And Bob just walks on and just carries with him this absolute comfort of being there. And this, and he's always seemed to me as well to understand, and I think it's the same thing we're talking about, he understands the ridiculousness of it all. And he understands all of the things that an audience might be thinking about seeing him there.
Yeah.
And I think...
You're right. I suppose, you know, you're sitting... Let's say you're an... And I sometimes try to sort of existentialist act of putting myself in the audience, watching me. What do I want to
yes.
see? I don't want to be sitting amongst 15 people and seeing somebody come on stage going, girls, make some noise!
Yeah, of course.
Boys, make... Why do I have to make some noise? I've here to see... Come on, no! Girls, make some...
Can
the boys...
The DJ voice.
Yeah, you know, just stop that. Just I'd rather you come and go... It's a bit quiet. Sorry, you know, I've got a bit of material now, which about being British is a bit like lying in bed in the middle of the night needing a wee. I'm not getting up. I'm not. So if it's a buzzy, happening sort of lively audience, I can say you lot are great, because quite often I find that a British audience isn't like this. They can be a bit like that. Middle of the night needing a wee, and if it is a quiet audience, look, I understand where we're coming from, because you represent what it's like to, you know, so I can contrive that bit of stuff, which looks semi-improvised, because I'm talking about them, not, you know, and it seems to work. But what it's doing is acknowledging the room, acknowledging the space that you're in, and
yes,
and you know,
yes, and there's something, there's a really sort of intangible quality of when you know that someone has experience. Like one of the, a nice compliment I was often paid in the early days of my stand-up career, which I think was to do with the fact I had so many years of experience on the street, I feel comfortable performing. And I said, like an early review I got said, as soon as this guy walks on stage, you relax and you think, oh, this is gonna be fine. So that was kind of level one of the thing, because I was walking on thinking, I'm happy to be here. But all the way at level infinity, wherever it is this, is a thing that I definitely saw you do when we gig together on those Riviera gigs, where you just, I don't know what it is. The nearest thing to it is that sense of walking on and going, like, do you know what I mean? Just raising your eyebrows, going like, here we all are. That sort of sense of acceptance of this is the thing. I don't really know what I'm asking anymore.
Well, I sort of see, yes. I'd like to think, yes, that I do have that in my armoury to be able to do that.
And maybe to have that in your armoury, you need to A, know that you're funny and that you can start being funny any second. B, have a load of material. It's almost that thing, like Alan was saying, having a load of material that you're not starting to do yet.
Yes.
Like the knowledge that you've got all that stuff.
Well, it's interesting. I remember seeing him at the Dominion Theatre, I think. He running around the stage, Alan Davis, just running around, going, hey, whoa, just running back. And me sitting in this theatre, why is he doing this? Feeling slightly awkward. Why is he? And then it just being brilliantly funny, the fact that relentless, I'm out of breath now. Look, I've covered loads of ground here. It's an enormous stage. Running around, and just running back and forwards, just running. That's what he was doing. Like, there's sort of childlike enthusiasm, and that was great. I mean, and that was, and I felt he was doing it that night on that stage for one night only. It wasn't the Alan Davis running around the stage thing. And sure enough, I saw him somewhere else to do something completely different.
Sure.
Playing that space. It's also having the confidence when those things don't work. Well, I'm talking about me doing, British audience or whatever, or talking about funny light fitting, and them going, sorry, where's the joke? And I tape all my stuff now. That's something that I've only started doing the last couple of years, but I tape every gig and then cringe and listen back to it.
Do you listen to every gig?
Yeah.
Very good. I make notes on
what I, especially when I'm trying out new bits. Mm-hmm. Sometimes if it's been a particularly cringy gig, I'll listen back to it and fast forward. So I don't have, I have 10 minutes of agony, not 20, so double time.
We all remember this. Carry on.
Yes, exactly. Get off. What was I talking about? Yeah, so I don't know what I was talking about.
That's okay.
We can edit.
We'll chuck a sting in here. So this is a lovely little interview with one of the very few comics with whom I really wouldn't mind being trapped in a lift. I've been a big fan of Mark's work since we first met. He's very, very funny, but he's got real natural comedy chops. He's obviously a very funny, silly bloke, but he also carries that experience of all of his years on the circuit. And he's just a joy to watch and to hang out with. We're going to talk about improvisation, Mark's origins in impro and how it pertains to stand-up. We're going to go into some detail on Mark's process as ever. There's some good ideas for collaboration, which I keep meaning to get around to doing myself. There's the joy of gigs that you let yourself off the hook to have to impress at, and how that can actually help your performance, and the benefits of taping oneself and actually bothering to listen back to it. And also Mark's going to be telling us how he copes with being such a seasoned actor himself, with the horror of people less experienced than you soaring ahead of you. In Mark's case, the answer to that is he copes very well indeed. So a real joy to speak to someone so upbeat and positive. Thank you all for tweeting in support of the show. It's been lovely to see people thanking each other on Twitter for recommending it. It's at ComComPod if you want to get in touch. Also info@comedianscomedian.com, or you can join the Facebook group. Keep the new hack coming in, comedianscomedian.com/new hack. You can also look at /blog for details of all my comedy guests, links to their web pages. And I've also had an idea for a Comedians Comedian web app. Haven't we all had an idea for an app? But if you're someone with experience of commercial app development and you fancy a little 5-minute chat, if you'd let me pick your brains about something that could make us both a lot of money, not likely, then do get in touch on one of those in one of those ways. Now, back to Mark Mayer.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number smart beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
The purpose, I suppose it's a slightly different subject, but the purpose of taping, which I find really sort of helpful now, is if I'm changing bits or trying out new bits of material, I'm sort of stating the obvious, I suppose, listening back and seeing where the laughs are, and then I'll sit with my laptop and pause and edit on, you know, I'll literally write everything out, my routines out longhand.
Let's have a look at some of these.
I've asked Wad of, well, I'm not going to read anything out, but I mean, an idea I'm working on at the moment is about my middle child, Sasha, who's five, talking about her reading, and teach. She's very proud of her reading, but she does this thing at school about sounding it out, which is what they
have to sound out every single
letter. And so I've got a story about me wanting to go and watch the football with my friends, and my wife saying, "You've got to spend some time with Sasha doing her sounding it out." So she, and the whole process of her literally reading out every single the ca-atter, cats atter. So we get the whole story. This is the first slight sort of, I suppose, departure sounds too dramatic, but this routine isn't jam-packed with points where I want to laugh here, I want to laugh there. It's more of a story, and it doesn't, and I've done it a few times, and it's a good thing to listen back to on my tape, because it builds to the end of the story, which is basically here saying that, reading the story, the cat sat on the mat. The next paragraph, and I say, you know, I get a text from my friends halfway through, where are you? You know, they're in the pub, and I text back, in living hell.
Yeah.
And then reading back, then she reads the next part of the story, the cat got off the mat. But her little bit of evilness is when she gets to the word mat, she doesn't say mat, she says mot. And I'm convinced she's doing this just to detain me from going to see.
Okay.
So, and I would say, why are you saying mat? And I lose my temper. Now, it's quite a delicate thing, because delicateness in terms of how I deliver this, because I don't want to come across, and the audience don't want to see you as some sort of, I'm not like that, my persona on stage is not of a monster dad whose daughter drives him to distraction. Mm-hmm. There is an element of that, but I know it's very, you've got to be very careful of the way in which you word it, if I'm talking in terms of truth, the truth of the story is I wouldn't text back, I'm in living hell. I would just go, I don't know where I am anymore, or whatever. I don't know, or I'll be another hour. Or
sure.
So it's finding those moments of truth, and also, I think, informing an audience of exactly what kind of a person you are. And that should be consistent from the... And that's the other thing I'm sort of trying to, after doing this for 25 years, trying to be consistent from the beginning of my set to the end, whether it be 20 minutes, 40 or an hour. So even if there are gags in there that are great gags, but are maybe a bit cruel, I think that that stays with an audience. I think they go, it's like having a conversation. Having a conversation with somebody in a pub and mentioning something early on that is a bit dark.
Yeah.
No matter how nice and sweet you are, there's always that residual thing in the back of the mind going, that guy's a bit of a twat.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, so I've... There's a joke about... Maybe I'm being too analytical about them. There's a joke that works very well and has worked well about Jake. Everything, he's seven, Jake, and everything is an accident. He runs around, everything is an accident. Everything, even before being accused, it was an accident. So we had the football through the TV room window incident recently.
Okay.
And he's crying. It was an accident. I said, no, Jake, you were in goal. I was taking a penalty. It's a lack of concentration. Now, not the greatest gag in the world, but I think, I'm trying... And I am actually stopping to do that gag now, because it's not... I don't think it's not very nice. What the subtext of that is you're a bit nasty to your son.
Yes, yes, okay.
So do you see what I'm saying? So I'm in the process of me taping and listening and hearing, you know, nice, good, solid, rounded laughs, and then suddenly getting to that joke, which gets a lot, but a different sort of laugh.
Yes.
Maybe a more blokey sort of laugh.
Sure.
I'll go, right, actually, you know, do I need to do that? Let's be ruthless here. Let's take that out and let's see what shape the set has now got.
Sure. So, I mean, it sounds like that analytical, you're afforded that analytical process by the fact that you do write very specifically. You're writing on a laptop, you're writing longhand, you write out the whole routine.
Yeah.
So you have somewhere all of your material, somewhere you've got it written down on a hard drive or something, or on a piece of paper, written out word for word.
Yes, yeah.
I have tried doing that, and I find that I often get waylaid by doing that into endless cutting and pasting and rejigging and stuff like that, and I come away not having really worked.
Well, it's learning it and then unlearning it. Learning it and then improvising around it and being loose with it, but still keeping those key words and those key sentences in. Because if it's too learned and too scripted, and I think an audience can feel
that. Have you always written stand-up in that way? Is that something that's happened over...
I think so, yeah. Probably from the copywriting... copywriting days, so it is taking. I enjoy the process of editing and taking out sentences here and there, and tightening things up.
That's nice. That's nice to hear, because I quite enjoy it as well. And I think I've convinced myself over the years that that's not proper writing, and you've got to write three funny words or a funny concept, and then improvise this funny concept. Actually, maybe I am more of a sit down typing.
Well, the pleasure of writing and having on your laptop going on a page, but then one extra line going onto the second page and going, I want to print this out, but what a waste of paper for this. Right, let's see if I can edit it to make it all shoot up onto one page. Brilliant.
For me, that's just select all font 11.
That's cheating. You're saying it all slightly smaller.
I'm going to whisper this bit to fit it on the page.
Or a bit faster, yes. Okay. The audience not laughing, but you're going, I fitted this all onto one page.
So in terms of your process then, do you take notes on a note-taking app when you're out and about? Do you make notes and write things down?
Scribble things down. As I'm driving to the gig, I think, right, what order do I want the set in?
Not in terms of ordering a set. I mean, in coming up with the clay, the raw material for writing a new bit, are you like a note taker, or what's the, in terms of a new, like the thing with going through Ella sounding it out, going through the reading, where did that first start? Did you find yourself doing it and think, oh, this is funny, make a note of that, and then come back to that on a Monday morning when you're writing? Or
I thought of it as a funny idea, possibly a funny idea, then did a gig, at a couple of school gigs, and told it, and I thought, well, I wonder if this is just relevant to parents who can identify, and then tried it at gigs. And it seemed to.
The genesis of that joke is that you say a funny idea at a gig before you then sit down and expand it and write it.
Yes, possibly it was a throwaway line. You know, I've had a bit of, you know, slightly frustrating day. I've spent half the day doing you know, three sentences with my daughter who's got us. We all know about the sounding it out. And I'm like, that might be it, and they'll go. Get a chuckle and go, wow, there could be something here. So let's have a look at, explore the whole sounding it out thing. Let's see if I can really...
I think a mistake I often make is to start off at the desk writing, where I don't know if my idea's funny yet. It's tickled me, but I've never said it.
There's no harm in that at all. There's a very good book, I don't know if you've seen the book, about writing stand-up, Sally Holloway.
Yes, I have. I think that goes to the
grassroots of how to write and how to develop ideas and joke webs and stuff, which I think is brilliant. And it's good to remind yourself of that.
So do you ever do anything
I have a little writing, workshop, which I do with a couple of other comics. We try to do it once a week, and we get together and do things like
that. Tell me about that. That's something I've considered doing.
It's great.
Just to not feel so mental and isolated all the time.
No, it's nice.
Who do you do that with?
With Mike Gunn and Angie McAvoy. We get together. So it's three very different sort of styles. So after chatting, drinking cups of tea and coffee, and eating for, you know, a good 3 hours, we'll squeeze in half an hour. We're pretty disciplined with it, so we'll meet and we'll all come with ideas and have sort of 10 minutes each on those ideas, and then
to say them to the other two and kind of say,
yeah,
so talk me through that. That's fascinating. Explain to me.
So we'll sit down. I've got this stuff on bloody blah on my daughter reading, and read it out, and then they'll give input or feedback, or I like that bit, or that bit doesn't work out, that doesn't resonate with me, or you know, the story's too long, why don't you edit this, and then somebody else will have a bash at something that they've been working on, and we'll go around like that. Or we'll say a great thing that I discipline that I used to teach a little bit of writing stand-up a long, long while ago. This is a post sort of copywriting days. I was just into that whole process of writing and learned various techniques, one of which is to sit and write, have an idea, have an opening sentence. I really hate I really hate going to the cinema alone because, mm-hmm. and then sit and write for 2 minutes without taking the pen off the paper. And, you know, the old fashioned days of writing before these technological things.
Yes, the equivalent now would be don't remove your keys from the keyboard, exactly. your fingers from the keys.
So just write for 2 minutes without, even if your brain seizes up, you've got to write the same word over and over again. Just keep doing that and then look at the comedy gold that you've created or not. But we'd do that, the three of us, and then read it out to the other two. So we'd give each other an opening sentence and then read it out. And you might get one line that would come out of it, or you might or you might not. But it gets the whole...
So it's quite... That sounds like quite a disciplined... It's not just a cup of tea and a chat about ideas. You actually...
Because we're all coming from the same place that we all want to come up with new stuff and new routines and new ideas... so I think it's good. It's a good discipline. And because I can't work at home. If I sit at home, I'll mess around on the computer or find plenty of, let's look at my Sky Planner. What happened? That documentary about Queen that I recorded 5 years. Let's watch that rather than getting to work. It's pathetic. So I'll go to the library there's a library in Crouch End. I'll go there and sit there. And then funny if there's a few other comics sitting about amongst the students.
Places probably with comics, I think.
And it's great. It's great. Sit there with a laptop it's like being at school. I'll see what I can come up with. Listen to the tape and I'm away from home and can do that.
And how often, how many times a week would you do that? What does your writing week look like?
Probably do that once a year. If that, to be honest. I try and do that 2 or 3 times a week.
Okay.
And there's no excuse not to.
Sure.
I tell myself.
Sure.
I try and do
that. What are your hours, out of interest, when you go and do that?
You're going to come and check out.
Do you get up and go, right, I'll do 9 till 12, or how long have you been?
Yes, exactly that. I take the kids to school and then get myself down to Crouch End and I'm there. Yes, I'd say 9 till 12, meet up with people for lunch, various other comics, have a bit of lunch, and then maybe post lunch you have that fatigue, you know, at my age I just want a bit of a lie down. But you feel it feels good. It's a good thing to do. I used to write radio I still occasionally do a lot of stuff for Radio 4, little comedy plays and dramas and stuff, not plays, what do you call them, comedy sitcom-y ideas.
Okay.
I can't think of the right word. Comedy drama stuff. And I used the library to do that. The library had the discipline, because you have to. You've got to work to a deadline. Mm. So I used the, you know, get away from it all and sit and do the
yes,
do that.
This chapter will be called Getting Out of the House.
It's an
important thing to be able to do.
So, it's great. It's great to be able to do that. To be allowed to do that by the wife and kids.
Tell me about the Jewish shows you were mentioning doing. There's not a Jewish circuit.
There's not.
As
there's
such.
A handful of Jewish comedians. And I don't talk about it in... There's no deep-seated, deep-rooted reason why I don't talk about it, other than it's not a huge part of my... life, in as much as, you know, having to get loads of Jewish material, talk about it in my normal set. But there is there are Jewish gigs, charity dues here and there. Okay. We have a Jewish Christmas show that we do every year.
I was booked for a Jewish gig for the Order of David Society, and I had to go because I've got the surname Goldsmith and I'm not Jewish. And I did have to sort of say at the beginning, you do know, don't you? You know, you booked me to do this thing. I've no idea. I mean, I'm just going to do a gig. But is there the assumption that you'll do a certain sort of material?
Yes, absolutely. And I've got stuff. I've got probably 2 hours of stuff. And it's interesting because with it, and I did a show last night up in Highgate, Jewish audience, and... You're at one with the audience much more so than doing a gig, let's say, in the West End, where there's all manner of walks of life, different religion, races, age groups, and what have you. With the Jewish demographic in terms of an audience is much more is a smaller demographic, I suppose, in as much as you've got 25 mid 20s to 60 year olds, sort of. Yeah, not particularly religious, but know enough about, as I do, about Jewish traditions that I can talk about certain subjects, whether it be this program, the Jewish Mother of the Year thing, that every Jewish person in that audience last night would have seen it or certainly know about it.
Sure.
So there's an immediate contact.
Sure.
You know, you're not searching, and so in a sense, with the Jewish shows, I found them easier to write.
Okay.
Because there's been, good evening, how are you? You know, I'll go on. I used to do this, you know, there's a pretty much guaranteed line to work at the start of the night. Good evening, how are you? Can I just point out that's a rhetorical question? As with a non-Jewish audience, to say, yeah, fine, you lot are analysing, hands are going up in the audience. I said, the show can, you know, overrun by 3 or 4 hours. I haven't even got to the first joke. I've got a bad back. I said, obviously, a Jewish person would never say they've got a bad back. You know, the specific medical terminology. I've got spondylosis of the vertebrae.
Yeah.
Thanks for it. You ask, he asks. You don't care. So that works. They all go, yes, if they're not like they know somebody that's like
yes,
that.
Yes, okay.
So that kind of shtick, to use a Jewish expression. And it's quite interesting, I went to see Jackie Mason.
How did you find that?
Well, he does stuff. He does a very clever thing that I think he does material that is targeted at a Jewish audience, but is so generic, but he says, Jewish people do this, Jewish people do that. And because it is 95% Jewish audience in there, they'll go, this is true. They don't know that this is a generic... I'll give you an example. I might explain it very well. He says he did a routine when I first saw him. It was at the Royal Albert Hall. He did a routine about Jewish people when they get on the plane and they say they're never happy with the seat. I've got an aisle seat. I don't want to sit in the aisle seat. I got a window seat. I don't want a window seat. They put me at the back of the plane. I don't want to be at the back of the plane. So they put me at the front of the plane. The Jewish people on the plane, they're never happy with. And I'm thinking, and people are roaring. And I'm thinking, that's true of anybody.
People
generally aren't happy with the seat they're given, but the Jewish people are sitting there. It's so funny. How does he know us?
These Jewish people, they always think that like you're a cat person or a dog person.
What's the fun? The Jewish people, you're waiting for a bus and the bus comes and you get on the bus. What is it with the Jewish people? So there's a lot of, you know.
Sure.
He does a fair bit of that in his stuff. So I took that on board.
And I've adapted the rest
use
of
that
my
technique.
Yes. You wrote an article for Chortle about game-playing comedians. I'm only mentioning that, really. I don't know if there's anything else to say about it other than what you wrote in the article, because it was masterful. I loved it. I want to mention it because it's available on the Chortle correspondence page, and I think everybody
is
in comedy.
Is it still up there, is it?
Oh, I would hope so. Yeah, I think they do. They catalogue all of them. Maybe I'm wrong. What you were describing there is very specifically was when you meet comedians and they play this sort of constant one-upmanship about how... I mean, the classic example is, how are you? Oh, jet-lagged. I mean, that's classic.
It's a true story.
Yeah, I'm sure it is. I'm probably guessing who did it.
we'll talk
about it after this. What other things do you find comedians doing, either socially or on stage, that you find frustrating?
I hate it when comedians tickle you. Particularly like a public place. I don't like an airport. I mean, would you not find that intensely irritating?
What I'm getting at, Mark, is you seem very happy. You seem like comedy is working for you. Yes.
Very interesting? I hopefully not now, but I used to get on the start of the second, I used to get a lot of people saying, you know, when I first met you, God, you were miserable. You're really depressing, and you seem to be angry at me. It was such a weird sort of, really? I've got no idea where that came. That's quite a worrying sort of trait to have. Maybe I was intense thought process about what I was going to be doing. I don't know, but it's very, it's great that, I mean, there are some comics that light up a room, aren't they? When they come in to a dressing room, you're just happy for their company, and those that are very insular and blinker.
And similarly, there are comics that light up a dressing room far too much that you roll your eyes and think,
stop performing.
Can you light up this dressing room a bit less?
Yes. Turn it down. Enough with the halogen. What was the.
I think Well, things that comedians do that irritate you, which is one conversation. I bounced very quickly into, come on, Mark, you are you really this happy? You've really made it all work for you. You're a shining example of how to be a happy comedian.
Really?
Yes,
oh,
I think
wow.
so.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, you're productive. You make lots of stuff. You're very funny. You don't seem to be. Is there anything
you know?
You
what I yes. You know what, Stu? I'd be lying if I said there aren't frustrations and there aren't, why, you know, the classic, why not me, watching stuff on TV or breaks that people have and this.
Sure.
It really doesn't get you anywhere. And I'm saying that, and they could very well, in an hour's time, put on something and go, what the hell is he doing?
Yeah.
It doesn't get you anywhere. And I there are things that, I'm not going to cite examples, but comedy friends of mine who listen to this will know exactly what I'm talking about. There's things that have been on that I've felt like, I should have had a chance there, could
yeah.
I? But there is nothing, what can you do? The more, it's like an open spot pestering a promoter for a gig. The more you do it, the more irritating you're going to be. So you just have to accept it. Go, that's the way it is. For whatever reason, I haven't got this, I haven't got that.
Particularly, I think, at the moment, when, for someone of your experience, when people, it's almost like everyone is still, like everyone's on tour at the moment, and lots of people who've been going, who've been at the top of the circuit, as you've been for a long time, are looking around and going, hang on a minute, this is, you know, this is either the bubble is going to burst soon, or whether it does or not, it's all exploding at the moment. It must be, I mean, do you think it's more frustrating now than it was 10 years ago?
Well, what I was going to say, sorry, I'll answer that, but what I was going to say was, to get over that sort of seething, bitter, maniacal paranoia, is just enjoying, going back to enjoying what I'm doing. So whether it be talk about my daughter's learning to read or whatever, I'm trying to find that enjoyment, and I am finding the enjoyment in performing again, which is not knocking out the same old stuff with dead behind the eyes feel about it, but actually really investing a bit of time.
Yeah, what is this about?
Yeah.
What it's about is coming up with a new thing, making it funny,
and enjoying it, and letting the audience know
the
enjoying.
Yeah.
I remember a friend of mine seeing me, the now defunct Battersea Jonglers, and he saw me two nights, and the first night was great, the second night wasn't, and he wasn't a stand-up. I think he's an accountant. I said, oh, it's weird that. He said, we weren't enjoying yourself up there. I said, what do you mean? He said, well, it was just, you weren't, were you? I went, no, not really. He said, well, how can you expect us to enjoy watching you if you're not enjoying it yourself? And I thought, wow, that really is, that's quite, maybe it's quite obvious, but I thought that was quite a sort of deep thing to sort of, to flag up, that if you're not enjoying yourself on stage or being seen to be enjoying yourself, we as an audience can't enjoy you.
Totally.
You can't enjoy, unless you're playing a character of some miserable shit, you know, but, some downtrodden, you know, depressive. But even then, there's an air of enjoyment, isn't there? I think even if you're being a bit negative. So, like I say, so you say, it's great to hear that hopefully more people think that I'm, everything's sunny and light and great. But I think I've got to that point by going, forget about the negative stuff. Do what you do. Do it as best that you can. And that's all you can hope to do. And we're all at different stages of success on me. I remember walking through Crouch End, and there was a big film set. I was half a bus in the middle of the road. It was a sort of slightly surreal scene. I'm walking on the way to the tube station. I pass this amazing film set, and it was Shaun of the Dead. Simon Pegg was having his makeup done. What's this? Oh, we're doing this thing about zombies. I said, all right. He said, yeah, it should be out in the new year. And then sort of mid small talk, because I know him from the circuit days. Mid small talk, they're one of the many crews. So, Simon, can we just have you over here for a minute? We're just going to check the light. Sorry, mate, I'll see you. What are you doing? So, you know, the reciprocal crew. So just off to Portsmouth.
Yeah.
Two shows. And it was that, you know, we were from the same world, but suddenly, you know, you come, why on a bus having me makeup done? You just do what you do. Because what can you possibly achieve other than meeting up with other comics, as we do, and again, I'm not setting myself up, and have a good old bitch and a moan, and, oh, God, how's he doing that? And he was on that as well, and What is other than feeling a bit better about yourself because you know you're not the only one doing
it? Yeah, there's definitely
that. There's other people that are bitter and twisted and resentful.
Definitely that. It's very positive.
You know, I phone up, you know, most of the clubs I'll play now, but there is a club. I mean, this is in this general scheme of life, this doesn't matter. There is a club that I'll phone up and have wanted to do a couple of gigs. Sorry, I haven't seen you before. I'll need to see you. But I've been on the circuit 174 years. What do you mean? But I've got to sort of let that go and don't... Mm. So, like you would... I've heard on a couple of the podcasts, being a podcast... comedian podcast fan, that a couple of people have said that thing of the one person that annoys you in an audience is the one that doesn't laugh. And I suppose the analogy there is that, you know, why should I be so pissed off about not doing a particular gig when I'm working everywhere else? But there's almost that sort of this sort of desire, this need to go to everybody, look, I should be working everywhere, just let it go, doesn't matter, I've got enough work, you know, in other places without being fixated about. And I think that's true. What you're talking about is absolutely true. Just focusing on what you're enjoying doing. The number of comics that we go, well, I'd like to do a podcast. Why can't I? You know, Stuart's doing it. Why?
I know everyone's doing a podcast now.
No, but not to the, you know, not to the extent and the caliber of brilliant comedians. But you know what I mean? There are scales. Sure. It's me seeing Simon Pegg at the bus.
Yes.
You know, there are different scales of of success that we strive to want. I want to do this, I want to do that, but it's a difficult thing. But it's almost just putting that to one side and just going, you know, I want to smash this gig with my new bit of material.
Because that's what it's really about.
That's and
for all of
what
the for all of the Simon Pegg, I'm sure he is thinking, what I really want to do is this joke that I've been working on very hard in this script. I really want to sell it really well, so when the thing comes out.
Yeah,
everyone goes, that was the best joke, you know.
I'll give you a good example of a bit of just the reality of the situation. I with the improv background, and just I've always enjoyed sort of any TV related improv show. Mm-hmm. And Would I Lie to You is fantastic. Mm-hmm. And I'm pals with Lee Mack, but would never abuse that friendship in terms of Lee, you know, in terms of nepotistic sort of, can you It once came up in conversation, because my wife is good friends with his wife anyway, and the kids play and all the rest of it. And it was slightly awkward, slightly embarrassing, because, you know, in effect, he's not going to wave a magic wand and say, I'm going to put you on this program. But what came out of the conversation was he has mentioned and had mentioned various comedian pals of his to the BBC before, who he thinks would be good for that program. Hopefully I was included in the roster. The reality is the BBC turn around and go, they're not, I don't know who they are, or I've heard of them, oh yeah, that person that does the circuit, but they're not flavour of the month, they're not on TV, they're not doing, you know, it's the, you know, chicken and egg thing, they're not doing this and that and the next, so why would I take a chance on them? And Lee would go back and say, well, because they're good and they've done this, and but that's not, you know, good enough at the moment, or that's not what's relevant for, whether I'm just... pointing the BBC out because that's, you know, Would I Lie to You? But I think that's true of a lot of TV programmes, that unless you've got that, you know, track record on TV, why take a risk? Why we're going to use the same people. Of course we're going to use the same people. So, you know, that's, again, a let it go moment. Just keep doing what you're doing, and hopefully... somewhere at some gig, somebody will see you and go, actually, he'd be quite good on that. But I suppose I'm trying to be in my headspace at the moment is just enjoying. I'm doing lots of gigs that aren't particularly well paid at the moment, but I'm doing them because I want the stage time and I want to be trying out new stuff and new ideas and not be, you know, have this determination to, I've got to do this by the end of this year, I'll be on this, on that. Because that's realistically not going to happen.
Finally, then. In terms of someone who is, you make your bread and butter doing circuit gigs, as do I, do you register, have you noticed a change? Do you feel that the industry is contracting? Do you feel there are fewer double ups available, fewer midweek gigs available? Do you have any sense? I think there's sort of the word on the hypothetical street is that, oh crikey, is the bubble going to burst? You know, there's quite a lot of sort of worried... like there's an awful lot of people starting comedy now. There's a lot more comics. I don't know if I'm doing as many gigs now as I was this time 2 years ago.
I think that's certainly true. I'm definitely, yeah.
I'm so glad you said that, because I suddenly thought I was describing this thing and you were going to go, no, not at all, it's just you, you're getting worse.
Yeah. In fact, I've got to cut this chat short. I've got a backlog of phone calls, exactly. I've got another podcast in 10 minutes. I think there's still a fair few gigs around, but they're not, the double up certainly are not as prevalent as they were, and I think the money doesn't change, the payment structure
doesn't reflect inflation.
It hasn't moved particularly. And if I want to thoroughly depress myself, I will look back to my diaries of 3 or 4 years ago and see that I was earning more than I am now. But whether I'm in, you know, I'm enjoying it more certainly now, and I'm earning enough to get by, to feed the kids, etc., and play poker with my friends, and give them all my money. Yes, we have a little comedy poker collective, which is quite nice.
Oh, go on, who's in that?
I don't want to name them. Exactly. In case their wives
Mr. White, Mr. Blue, Mr. Green. Yeah.
Exactly. Jeff Green, no.
Andy White.
I know.
Josh Blue, he's American.
Yeah, exactly. Adam Blue. I'm pretty busy with the work, but it's certainly not expanded. There's not a whole load more comedy clubs than there were. I mean, I don't know if you find that. There's not, there's the same established ones. But I think a lot of clubs open and then close quite quickly when they suddenly they can't work out why they're not making heaps of money, why it's not packed out every week.
Have you ever been to the Edinburgh Festival?
I have.
When did you last go?
I went in 2004 was the last time.
Okay.
I think I've done 5 Edinburgh shows. I did a show about giving up smoking.
Okay.
It wasn't the snappiest of titles.
Yeah, you addicted to smoking up.
Yes. It was called Giving Up, which was about giving up smoking.
I remember that.
I think the best thing about it was the title. In the attic in the Pleasance, which was very hot and still is apparently.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Very hot.
Yes.
2004 was the last time I went out, which was a show called Objects.
Okay.
Which is all about if inanimate objects could talk, what they would say. And it was autobiographical. I became these different objects. And I'm a big fan of, if no man stand up, I like doing characters and voices and accents.
Yes.
So that allowed me to crowbar in every accent and character. And so it was, it was autobiographical. And it was great fun to do. And then Radio 4 gave me the chance to do it as a Radio 4 thing, which was great. But a real challenge because it was very visual.
Yes, okay.
So I had to sort of rethink the whole structure of it to do it for radio, which was, I love that, again, the discipline of having to write something that is a visual thing but make it work on radio. So that was great fun to do. But yes,
would you go up again? What do you see as the value of the Edinburgh Festival? Have you, like,
I think the joy of doing an hour show, if you're enjoying the show, for that consistently in really honing it and developing it for that period of time, 3 or 4 weeks or whatever, however long you're doing it, is a good thing. But I found it hard. I have to be honest. I found it hard, and I found it hard because I wasn't in the flurry of newer names. And I'm keep harping on about this, but the reality was whether I had good PR behind me. I had did the whole things that you need to do, posters and what have you, and because I was up against a lot of other really good acts and shows, it was well received. I got returning journeys of the Perrier panel and the like, but
okay.
I think it was 2 reviews I got and a couple of smaller bits and pieces, but both reviews said, one actually said sadly overlooked, and someone else said a variation on that theme.
Yeah.
Why haven't more people seen this? And there were 2 4-star reviews, and that was almost more depressing.
Yes,
you're talking about happy Mark. Here's sad and depressed Mark. I was very, very low and very depressed about that, because I thought, I've put so much work into this. It was a whole, you know, there was a whole showbiz. I'd had costumes made for each of these characters. I had a original sort of music written, which I had on a CD that... do you remember the days of CDs?
No.
the youth of today. So, and it, yeah, like I say, I put a lot of time and effort into the thing. So the vindication was having it picked up by Radio 4. And when I came back, I did a little run of the show at the Soho, which was, so I suddenly felt, great, yes, it's getting a bit of attention. I felt it deserved in Edinburgh, but didn't. But like I say, both reviews reflected this. Why aren't people looking at this? It's really good. Well, I mean, I don't know what you can do in those situations other than just sort of knuckling down and just doing the show. And it wasn't stand-up. It was more sort of, you know, comedy drama.
Okay.
It's a piece rather than stand-up. So would I go back again? I probably would. I probably would go back. But I think it's so important. I mean, you've been more recently than I have. But I think it's almost more important to have the whole publicity machine behind you, the time, what the venue, where you are, what kind of I mean, I went up, I did a charity thing this year just as a one-off thing for a friend of mine, and I saw the posters. I had no idea that they're actually the sizes of the sides of houses.
It's incredible.
I mean, enormous. A bus side of just a regular poster, some of whom I have to say I'd never heard of before, but I thought, my god, this is
a lot of people.
Apparently, about £3,500 per poster. So people are ploughing in. You must be looking in terms of £20,000-£30,000.
Yeah. I think often if someone is releasing a DVD that year, then they roll into the DVD promotion budget.
Right.
They roll in the Edinburgh budget that. So because it's
So
presumably that's the money for the DVD promotion.
Yeah.
Then doing that, which is that's one way of doing it, but it kind of. It seems impossible to compete with.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. And I think
it just doesn't seem like it's fringe anymore, which is fine. You know, there's room for doing 1,000-seater venues every night and all the rest of it, but maybe that could be done at a different time to the Edinburgh Fringe.
I'd be interested to know what's the argument against that? You've got a really good solid hour finding a nice venue, the Hen and Chickens or wherever, a nice sort of, you know, not one of the big all singing or dancing West End, and doing it here for a month. What's the
especially
argument
if you
against
threw the
that?
Equivalent money at it?
Because exactly. And you've got the hopefully the attention of the press and punters that you are fighting for up there.
Well, that's it. Would you have that if you can kind of blag it and get the Independent and the Guardian and someone else in on the strength of an Edinburgh show? Would those papers come and see you in Camden?
I don't know,
but it's an expensive gamble.
I'd like to do it again if somebody else paid for everything. And I didn't have to worry, and brought in cardboard cutouts of an audience.
Yeah,
it's just like those fairground things. You could just throw tennis balls so they weren't smiling and perfectly edged faces.
That would be lovely. There we go. Concept for a show. Edinburgh High concept. Yes. No audience allowed.
Yeah, exactly. You could take it sold out every night, but with cardboard cutouts. So. Sold out. Yes.
That will do us. Thank you very much, Mark. I can hear in the background your baby has returned home. Presumably with a parent rather than just on her own.
Oh, she's very independent.
I'd very much like
she's
to go
1 year, 2 months
over
and
her.
Very, very, very independent.
Lovely job. Thank you very much for talking to me.
Thank you. Thank you.
So that was Mark, a fantastic chat. Hope you enjoyed it as much as I did. Next week, we have Sam Wills, known to many of you as the boy with tape on his face. He's going to be removing the tape for a genuinely fascinating conversation about how he makes his material. I think that's going to become a firm favourite, that podcast. That was one of the ones recorded live at the Gilded Balloon at this year's Edinburgh Festival. So Sam Wills next week. And all this week, this is just a little recommendation of mine. One of the best shows I saw at Edinburgh this year was Dr. Brown. And I'm actually very excited to be doing his clowning course later this month. He's at Soho Theatre all week, possibly all fortnight, I'm not quite sure, but it's called something like so just search Dr. Brown at the Soho Theatre. I cannot recommend that show enough. I think it's really mind expanding and very, very funny. Thank you to everybody. Thanks to 2Entertain for their support. Thanks to my guest this week, Mark Mayer. Thanks to Graham Cropford, Asher Trelevin and Tom Wateracre. As always, I've been Stuart Goldsmith. I'll speak to you soon. Can you tell I recorded all of that in a hurry? I'm late for a gig. Ah!
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.